Before we get started, a quick disclaimer. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. Nothing you hear is an offer or solicitation to buy or sell any investment. Hello, welcome to the Rangeley Capital Podcast. I'm Chris DeMuth, a PM at Rangeley. With me, as always, is my co-host and fellow Rangeley PM, Andrew Walker. Today, we're looking at Verizon's M&A opportunities, the feeding frenzy that could happen in the telecom space in the weeks ahead, before catching up with Steve Ballmer, formerly of Microsoft, and now trying to build a business-like 10K and report for the United States of America, largely the government, but also with other public policy sensitive statistics about the economy and the market. To start off with, Verizon didn't buy anything in the just completed FCC spectrum auction, but it appears as if that spectrum is about the only thing that Verizon doesn't want to own. They're considering besting AT&T's deal with Straight Path, $1.25 billion now, and possibly $1.5 billion when they're done. He's also looking at Comcast, $181 billion, Disney, $179, and CBS at $31. Presumably, he won't buy all of them, but that's over $390 billion of market cap that he is looking at, big even for a $200 billion company. He just this week bought $1 billion of cable. That's a lot of cable and related equipment from Corning, looking forward to Verizon's 5G rollout. So that's clearly on his mind, and I think a big topic is what he needs for that. So, Andrew, I will start with that. What do you think about Verizon's next steps?
Yeah, so I thought there were a lot interesting. So, you know, he gave this wide-ranging Bloomberg interview that you're quoting where he said, yeah, we might buy, we're open, like our phone book's open, we might buy Comcast, we might buy Disney, we might buy CBS. And it was just strange. Like, I don't think I've ever seen someone come out and just almost like word vomit this list of huge companies that they might look to, that they might go look to buy. I also think it's interesting, like, there's two very divergent strategies you're talking about there. You know, if you go by, well, Comcast fits them pretty well, because with Comcast you get NBC, right? Comcast owns NBC and DreamWorks. So you get a bunch of content that kind of rivals, it lets you keep up with AT&T buying Time Warner, but you also get all of the Comcast cable assets as well. So you can kind of build that nationwide quad play with cable, phone, TV, and wireless, and use all of Comcast cable backbone to support your build out of 5G. So that's interesting, but it's massive, massive, massive. And you're really buying Comcast thinking about the cable assets, not the NBC assets, because the cable assets just dwarf the NBC assets. Whereas if you go look at Disney, I mean, it would be the largest media acquisition of all time. After debt, it's over $200 billion. That's taking the Time Warner acquisition that AT&T is doing and just taking it to the absolute extreme, because you're going and going after all this different set of content. And in many ways, it's a little bit different than the Time Warner acquisition, because the Time Warner acquisition is a lot about HBO, which is that subscription premium service, whereas Disney doesn't really have that subscription premium service figured out. They've got fantastic content assets, but they don't have a subscription play. So if they're going after them, Verizon's kind of saying, hey, between Yahoo and AOL, we and our Go90 division, we'll figure out distribution. We just need to get more content to pair with all these things. So tremendously interesting, tremendously interesting.
He seems like he's going to do something. I mean, nothing seems like one of the least likely conclusions. He seems like the two concerns are not dense enough on the assets that he needs for 5G, and not content rich enough for the, you know, probably if he does an OTT, if he does other delivery, especially video over phone, they want something to show on it. And he seems like both of those is kind of gnawing at him right now.
Yeah, and it was interesting because back in December, he did this big analyst interview where he said, listen, we're not interested in a mega transformative deal. And he specifically said, we're not interested in Dish or CBS, and said, we don't want to manage talent. We don't want to be in the contest business. In January, he kind of hinted, hey, maybe we're going after Charter or Comcast to get the backbone. But this is a big difference. Mm-hmm. And to throw in CBS after he had said he wasn't in there. And then it was interesting to me as well that Dish, which is a very good fit for them, I think, was not on there. Dish has a lot of spectrum, and Verizon needs spectrum. I saw some stats today that said Verizon has the lowest ratio of spectrum to subscribers by far of any of the four wireless companies. And Dish also has, you know, the Dish TV and the OTT app, which helps them kind of counteract AT&T's DirecTV play. So I thought it was very interesting Dish was not on there.
I think the kind of Sun Tzu art of war Spidey sense would say that the thing that he didn't mention is what he's actually going to do would be Dish. I mean, that would really fit, as opposed to when he was kind of jawboning about M&A, it's like if we were chatting about what they might do in theory, you know, just an analyst kind of pouring through options, but he's the CEO of the company. Very unusual.
One thing we talk about a lot is when there are these news reports that get leaked and somebody says, oh, Amazon might buy Whole Foods. And we're like, okay, we don't think it's there, but just because one person at the company looked at it, like a CEO should always be assessing his options. But this is almost like the CEO is assessing his options in public. Just super strange to just go throw all of those out there.
My guess is that Comcast, which would make a lot of sense, is not necessarily looking to sell. Their management team probably is more obstinate. Charter's the one that I always think is just price sensitive. They would sell today, they would not sell today based on price. So if somebody wants to overpay for them, I think they're probably quite available, have the best management team if anybody needs to hire. Disney's interesting on the management side in that they don't have a long-term CEO. Bob Iger wants to leave. He has nobody teed up to replace him. So M&A from that perspective, and just perfect content that you can crank through any pipe forever. I mean, their old content's just, perfect.
On the Disney front, I think two things are interesting. I saw some quotes earlier this week. They're a little bit stale, but John Malone was talking about, hey, if you were Disney, you probably need to jettison ESPN at some point, sell it to some private investors. And one of the things Verizon was saying was, Disney would be so perfect for us if they didn't have ESPN. So it really seems like ESPN might be on the chopping block from a lot of different angles for people who are kind of strategically interested in Disney. But if you're going to go for Disney and you're Verizon, don't you kind of wait to see the resolution of the AT&T Time Warner deal right now? You know, I think both of us think that will get approved, but wait, make sure that it can get approved before you kind of sign on the dotted line and commit to the complexity of this $200 billion plus possible purchase.
That's a very good point. I believe that ESPN, ticker ESPN, is available and would make sense in a spun off company. Would make it much more bite-sized and really signal if Disney wanted to be bite-sized for a deal. CBS, one of the other potential targets, has news as recently or as soon as over the next 24 hours in terms of some deregulation and changes to UHF that could really impact its value. Not long to wait, but that's going to be something that people are going to be looking at, thinking about CBS.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, the only nice thing with CBS and Dish, they both have kind of controlled majority owners, so the negotiations there might be a little bit simpler than if you're going at Disney, where you're going to, you know, Disney has huge, massive shareholders. It's a lot more diverse. You might have a lot of different interests there, but that's the only thing I can think of that might favor one of those two. Of course, they're also much more bite-sized. I mean, a $200 billion plus acquisition is just really crazy to think about. But hey, I guess anything can happen.
It helps the talks to keep it confidential, and it even just helps, you know, looking at the stocks, it's reasonably likely that you could just see an announcement one day without the kind of normal kind of leaky process leading to it, which can be counterproductive. That's what I wanted to discuss on that. Are you ready to move on to other things? Steve Ballmer, we haven't heard from much recently. I don't know if he was the number one, or he's probably close to the top in terms of people who were enriched by their leaving the company.
Yeah.
His wealth went up by billions by the fact that he left Microsoft. I think I would feel good about that. I'd have mixed feelings.
I don't know.
Ego, I mean, it would hurt.
But... You know, so, I mean, Steve Ballmer, I think he's worth like $20 billion. Yeah. So the day he left Microsoft, I think the stock went up by 10%. Uh-huh. So he went from 20 to 22.
Yeah.
But you know, at that point, you're worth so much money. Like, I think my ego would be more hurt.
More
that
sensitive.
Investors were so negative on me that me leaving a company could single-handedly increase its value by $25 to $30 billion.
You know, on the other hand, he is somebody, even though he's extremely wealthy, he does seem to have fun with it. You know, I always think that the kind of extreme misers and kind of hand-wringers amongst the extreme wealthy kind of take away so much of the fun, that when you have the Steve Ballmers, Larry Ellison probably very much as well, who actually have something to do with billions of dollars, it's kind of fun. You know, he has a boat with a submarine and so forth. And so he probably was thinking of some cool stuff he could spend the marginal billion on.
Yeah, look, he bought the Clippers for $2 billion. I think people at the time, it was so funny because the sales book for the Clippers got leaked. Mm-hmm. And the high end of the bids that bankers were kind of projecting to were about $1.5 billion. And he just blew everyone away with a $2 billion bid. But I've seen a lot of quotes with him about his time with the Clippers. And he seems to be having a fantastic time. Yeah. And I also think he's thinking about a lot of really interesting ways to kind of revolutionize the business side of owning a team.
And come to think of it, the Clippers was that purchase that was about the marginal amount in terms of the wealth change on him leaving Microsoft. Well, while we're thinking about Steve Ballmer right now, is just this week, he had a conversation, the background is he had a conversation with his wife that was probably looking at you know, Melinda Gates about to get kind of sainted and beatified and all of this great press on her generosity. And meanwhile, the Ballmers are kind of kicking back, having fun on their big boat. But she probably was looking at this and saying, hey, we need to get out there on some more philanthropy. And his first reaction to that is, well, we pay huge tax bills every year. Isn't that the world's biggest philanthropy? And then turning back and saying, hey, is that really right? Where is this money going?
Yeah.
What is it? And spent, I think it was $10 million so far to put together a very kind of West Coast IT, nicely kind of formatted and framed a budget and kind of assessment of the United States, especially the U.S. government. So, Andrew, I don't know if, how much of this you looked at in detail. I've been kind of pouring through it, found it very interesting, but wanted to get your sense. So what do you think about all this?
Yeah, so I flipped through the website a little bit. You know, I think the most interesting thing was reading the article and his thought process behind it. Like, I didn't realize that none of this information existed. Like, it was just a little bit crazy to me that the government takes so much money in, and anybody who wanted to kind of be an accountability person had to go to all these various different databases and kind of put it all together themselves. I was just surprised in general that the accountability metrics didn't exist. So I thought it was a fantastically cool project. There's just so much data in there. It's tough to kind of really dive into unless you're going to make it a full-time job almost.
Yeah, you know, when you look at this past century, we really went full circle from company data with the government being completely opaque, and people like Ben Graham, you know, going to DC to find the utility data that now we can find online in seconds. So the government standards went from very low to very high in terms of transparency, data, and just having consistent formatting for companies. So now I would actually say it's pretty good. You can kind of you can collect it pretty easily. It is broadly available and analyzed, but they don't do it to themselves. So I think the fact that he got out there was healthy and good. I had a few specific reactions on the substance. You know, if you look at it and you compare it to the kind of the data, and I think data is so important. I think that you're BS if you say you care about something but don't measure it, that measuring is the activity of people who are serious about a topic, that if you compare it to kind of a frivolous banter about it, boy, number one, entitlements, such a huge thing. The budget has lots of topics like foreign aid comes up constantly. It's huge amounts of ink spilled. It's tiny. It's almost not worth mentioning.
I had the same thoughts. You know, like, you see these things and I'll make a number up, you know, $2 billion spent on welfare every year. And then you go look at the actual budget and the percentage, and it's the tiniest little sliver of thing. And you're kind of like, why the heck are we even thinking about this? You know, a couple weeks ago, the Trump administration said they were going to stop releasing their visitor logs. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons they gave for that was they were going to save $70,000 a year on the release and tracking of the visitor logs. And they spent more than that in the PR move trying to defend the decision not to release the visitor logs. It's like sometimes these little tiny things, they just don't matter in the grand scheme of things in the giant, in the vast swarm that is the U.S. government.
I think that one of the things that if you focus on the big, big programs, it's scarier than if you were well beneath the efficiency curve, but there were things that were unpopular or stupid, just waste, fraud, and abuse that you could easily kind of tweak. A big concern I have looking at this is that the vast parts of the budget where things are really out of control are big, popular, entrenched programs that have no history of getting cut back or eliminated, and that there's not any kind of consensus for either raising taxes to pay for them or having taxes raised to fit the debt or having spending cut to fit the taxes.
Yeah.
And so there's not a the democracy plus the demography is on one side, the budget is on the other, and there's not some kind of trite rhetoric that you could use to fit the two together. I tried, though, to come up with a couple little thoughts in terms of areas that they're not clearly Republican, Democrat, conservative, a liberal that I was just going to tick off. One was, when you look at the taxes right now, I would say that people could describe them in different ways, but they look pretty high, progressive, and uneven. And while the first two attributes could be controversial, the third should be something where there should be tons of consensus between liberals and conservatives. And when I say uneven, I mean it's not a smooth progression. Mm-hmm. Whatever the level of progressivity is, whatever the that philosophical view, which I would kick to somebody else, it shouldn't be so spotty that you can have over 100% marginal tax rates along the way. Mm-hmm. Where many, many people do. If you look at net transfers in addition to the taxes, I think that's something that if people were more aware of could be confronted. And then second point I'd mention in a little conclusion is that virtue signaling is clearly such a big part of government. On the right, I would say if you look at the war on drugs or illegal immigration, on the left, the war on poverty, Head Start, and federalizing education generally, there's so many things where there's just no data that they work, but that that people still talk about. I mean, illegal immigration is a constant right now in political discourse. Not just immigration, but illegal immigration is almost the perfect partial solution to our entitlement problem. People who come in at work age, put tons of money into the economy, paying payroll taxes, and then disappear by the time they'd be beneficiaries. And I think the real contribution Ballmer can make is towards an approach where priorities are weighed against each other, against their costs, and where policies are responsible for consequences, intended and not just their intent, not just at the superficial level of rhetoric. So anyways, that was my, thought on that.
Perfect.
Anything? Do you want the last word?
No. You took it. I think we're way over time. Wrap up there?
All the time we have for today and more. Before we hit our disclosures, a reminder, if you like the podcast, please follow us, rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, or Audioboom. And disclosure, we are long-time Warner.
Yep, that's it.
Thank you. Bye.
All right.